My best effort at this was borrowed from a fencing instruction given to Cyrano de Bergerac. Hold the foil as a bird, not so loosely that it can fly away, but not so tightly that you squeeze the life out of it. It is a nice metaphor, but in reality, the only way to find the right degree of pressure to apply to the grip is by experiencing it in action and discovering what feels comfortable and what works. If you have been following the evolution of approved grips in the last few years, you will have noticed the dominance of the universally approved Eastern forehand grip. Shake hands grip with the V formed by the thumb and forefinger on the top panel of the racket. Although this is still the grip approved in United States Tennis Association publications, it has been abandoned by many tournament players in favor of the semi-western grip, approximately a quarter turn to the right of the eastern grip for right-handed players. How did these players come to use this grip, and why are they sticking with it? Could it be that they discovered it, and that their experience has continued to validate its use? They broke with dogma, not because the dogma was wrong, but because they found something that worked better for them. Footwork. Footwork is clearly one of the critical variables for the successful execution of any shot in tennis. It provides the foundation that supports the body's movement as it swings to hit the ball. Much has been written about this subject, and it is all too easy to get the feet tangled or feel awkward in the process of obeying a myriad of footwork instructions. We will take another approach. The footwork technique most commonly taught by teaching professionals on the backhand has remained relatively unchanged over the past 20 years. Right-handed players are typically instructed to hit the ball with your feet moving forward toward the ball at an approximately 45-degree angle with your feet comfortably separated. It is commonly explained that one tends to lose balance if the feet are too close together, and that your weight should transfer from the back foot toward the front foot as you move to strike the ball. Assuming that these two instructions can be useful guides to learning footwork technique, how can they best be used? First, resist the temptation to immediately obey them. The first step is to closely observe your own footwork, especially as it relates to one of the variables in the instruction, say, weight transfer. Without making any conscious changes in your weight shift, simply observe how the transfer is occurring now. As you continue your observation, chances are your weight will automatically begin to make some changes, that is, if any change is needed. You can let Self 2 experiment until it finds what feels best and works best for you. The same approach can be used with discovering the proper angle. Knowing what 45 degrees might look like, you can simply observe the angle with which your front foot steps toward the ball. If during your initial observations you observe your foot moving significantly less or more than the desired angle, don't force it. Just allow Self 2 to approximate the desired angle until it feels comfortable. You are asking, it is executing. Be prepared for the fact that sometimes Self 2 may find that what works best for it is not in conformity with the instruction. Such might well be the case with the footwork on the forehand side. In contrast to the backhand, what has been accepted as correct footwork on the forehand has changed dramatically over the past 20 years. When the first edition of this book was published, it was commonly taught that the footwork on the forehand should be close to the same as on the backhand, except with the other foot moving forward toward the ball at approximately a 45-degree angle. That was certainly the way I was taught when I first learned the game over 50 years ago. In fact, when I learned, the correct footwork steps were painted on a black rubber mat. To learn the prescribed footwork on the running forehand, I was trained to place my feet in the printed steps over and over again, until I could do it without looking. Then, when taking my lesson, failure to reproduce that exact footwork was a cue to the instructor to give corrective instructions. However, now there are two alternative and commonly approved footworks recommended. One way, called the open stance forehand, was discovered and propagated by clay court players who began hitting with weight established on their right or back foot instead of transferring weight to the front foot. Instead of stepping into the ball with the left foot, they would step horizontally, parallel to the baseline, with their right foot assuming an almost 180-degree stance. They would turn their shoulders, rotate their hips, and unwind like a corkscrew to hit the ball. Easier to observe than to describe, the open stance forehand proved very effective on clay courts and ultimately was adapted by many professionals playing on hard courts or grass as well. It had the advantage of making it easier to produce topspin and also to return to the center of the court faster than when hitting off of one's left foot. This evolution is especially interesting to me, as I remember the countless times I was scolded for hitting the forehand in this way before it had become approved. To learn the footwork for this open stance forehand, along with the other elements of the swing that go with it, would be a daunting task if you had to break it into its component parts, learn them by means of instructions, and then put them all together. However, it might not be so difficult to learn if you observed someone who did the stroke well, let yourself play around with it, before putting your attention to the details of the swing. During this experiment, it would be important to be totally non-judgmental, even unconcerned about your results, until you got a feel for the swing as a whole. Not until then would you focus your attention on the specifics and allow them to refine themselves. When you felt ready, you might choose to focus attention on how much your hips were rotating, observe your shoulder turn, the action of your arm, etc. You would observe each of these in turn, just as you did the weight distribution of your feet on the backhand, without any conscious effort to make them conform to a certain pattern, but allowing yourself to discover the feel that is comfortable for your body and personality and produces effective results. If you learned how to hit the open stance forehand, that does not mean that you have to use it on every shot, or that it is even the correct way to hit the forehand. The other accepted technique for hitting the forehand, called the semi-open stance, is done by forming a 90 to 100 degree angle between your 2 feet and the baseline. Obviously, this is a compromise between the traditional footwork and the open stance forehand, and shares some of the advantages of each. If you so choose, you can master all 3 forehands and use each when it seems appropriate. The important thing is that the choice is kept in your court, and that instead of trying to fit yourself or your stroke into a preconceived model, you fit the models to you, and use them only to help you discover and develop the skills you desire. To do otherwise is to diminish your potential as a player and as a learner. When you understand how simple attention can be used to learn any technical aspect of the game, with or without the aid of a technical instruction as a guide, it is quite an easy matter to discover the important places to focus your attention and then use the same simple process of discovering from experience. A few critical focal points from the ground strokes are summarized below. You could take any instruction from any tennis magazine or book and add to the list. A partial ground stroke checklist. 1. Backswing. Exactly where is the head of your racket at the back of your swing? Where is the ball when you initiate your backswing? What happens with the face of the racket during the backswing? 2. Impact. Can you feel where the ball is meeting the racket at impact? How is your weight distributed? What is the angle of racket face at impact? How long can you feel the ball on the face of the racket? To what extent can you feel the kind and amount of spin being imparted to the ball? How solid does a shot feel, or how much vibration is sent up your arm at impact? How far in front of or behind you is the ball at impact? 3. Follow through. Where does your racket finish? In what direction? What has happened to the face of the racket since impact? Is there any hesitancy or resistance experienced during the follow through? 4. Footwork. How is your weight distributed during preparation and at impact? What happens to your balance during the shot? How many steps did you take to get to the ball? What size are the steps? What kind of sounds do your feet make on the court as you move? When the ball approaches you, do you retreat, advance, or hold your ground? From how solid a base are you hitting the ball? The serve. Compared with the other strokes of tennis, the serve is the most complicated. Both arms are involved in the stroke, and your hitting arm is making simultaneous movements of shoulder, elbow, and wrist. The movements of the serve are much too complicated for self-one to master by memorizing instructions for each element of the stroke. But it is not so difficult if you let self-two do the learning by focusing attention on the different elements of the stroke, as well as the stroke as a whole. Some places to focus attention on the serve. In general, there are some specific places where it can help to focus your attention for practicing your serve. Remember, the fundamental goal is still the same: over the net and into the court with power, accuracy, and consistency. Here are just a few variables to consider. The toss. How high is it? How far does it drop, if at all, before contact with your racket? How much forward or behind, right or left of the toe of your front foot? Balance. Is there any time during the serve when you feel off balance? What is the direction of your momentum at follow-through? How is your weight distributed during the serve? Rhythm. Observe the rhythm of your serve. Count the cadence of the rhythm you feel by saying, da, da, da. One da at the moment you start the serve, one at hit as you bring the racket up, and one at contact. Feel and listen to the rhythm until you find what feels best and works best for you. Racket position and wrist snap. Where is your racket at the moment before moving forward toward the ball? Is your racket coming around the right side of the ball or the left? Hitting it flat or coming from left to right? To what extent? To what extent is your wrist snapping at impact? At what point in the swing does it begin to release? Power. Because power is so sought after on the serve, it is not unusual for players to try too hard to produce it, and in the process to over-tighten the muscles of wrist and arm. Ironically, the over-tightening of these muscles has the opposite effect on power. It reduces power by making it more difficult for the wrist and elbow to release freely. So again, the important point is to observe the tightness of your muscles so that you can experientially find the degree of tension that provides the best results. Your teaching pro can be helpful in pointing out the best focus of attention for your particular serve at its current state of development. As long as you take his guidance as an opportunity to explore your own experience, you really cannot help but learn in a natural and effective manner. Besides the fact that we all have to learn as individuals, it is also obvious that there is no one best way to serve for everyone. If there were, why do so many of the best servers in tennis today serve so differently? Each may have learned things from others, but each of them evolved over time a way of serving that suited his own body, skill level, personality traits, in short, himself. And their process is still evolving. And in spite of all the credit they might give to different players or coaches for helping them find their serves, their primary development was directed from within themselves by that simple process of what feels good and what works for each individual. As with many of the other strokes in tennis, the orthodox approach to the serve is under challenge by pros who seem to be breaking out of its mold. When I learned to serve some 50 years ago, my coach, John Gardner, one of the best in the field, taught the approved method of the time. To get the arms moving in the correct direction and rhythm, we chanted the mantra, down together, up together, hit. What this meant was that both the tossing and the hitting arm were brought down at the same time. Then, as the tossing arm was raised to toss the ball, the hitting arm was also raised and dropped down the back, poised for the moment of hit, much like a football quarterback cocks his arm in preparation to throw a forward pass. Then, depending on how high the ball was tossed, the hitting arm would surge forward to strike the ball so that it would be fully extended at impact and then follow through past the feet. Basic tennis gospel for 50 years. Then, just today, in the midst of writing this section on serving, I read an article in this month's Tennis Magazine that pointed out that the best servers in the game today, including Steffi Graf, Todd Martin, Pete Sampras, Mark Philippoussis, and Goran Ivanišević, do not in fact follow this down-together, up-together motion. So from the point of view of the right way to serve, all these great players are doing it wrong. The article was entitled, Stagger Your Arms for Serving, and the author recommended that when the tossing arm is fully extended for the toss, the hitting arm should still be pointing down toward the court. To learn to serve like these pros, the player is instructed thusly. As the tossing arm rises, drop the hitting arm back and down, followed by this explanation. The old up-together technique, which may seem more rhythmic, actually works against creating power for some players, because it forces the hitting arm to pause at the top of the backswing, destroying the buildup of momentum to that point. The pictures of these pros serving makes it obvious that they are doing something very differently. The instruction continues. Most important of all, note how each of these players has his or her hitting arm in the palm down position, i.e. the hitting hand palm, is facing the ground at the moment the ball is released. This is necessary to achieve the lasso effect of a good serve, in which the racket is then quickly raised above the head and circled down around the back before snapping up to strike the ball. I cite this instruction for two reasons. First, to show that gospels change, and they are changed by people who had the courage to experiment outside the boundaries of the existing doctrine and trust in their own learning process. The second reason is to suggest that the prescribed way of making a change itself needs to change. When I read the above instruction for the so-called staggered arm timing, my mind is beset with several doubts. Do I even understand what is meant by such terms as lasso effect or hitting hand palm is facing the ground? The next doubt that knocks at my door is, even if I did understand the instructions, could I follow them? Then, I wonder if I'm going to be able to get rid of my old way of serving that I've practiced diligently for years. And finally, just because this way of serving works for professionals at their level, does that mean it is best for me? So how can you benefit from such an article that may in fact be pointing out a valid new discovery about the serve? First, you might want to get clear on why you might want to experiment with making a change in the first place. It may not be sufficient reason that some top pros serve differently now, or that this way of serving is coming into fashion. On the other hand, you may feel that if there is a way for you to increase power on your serve, it would be worth the effort of experimentation for you. This first step of knowing what results you want is critical to maintaining control of the learning process where it belongs, with you. After reading an article or watching some people serve with a new method, don't jump to the conclusion that this new way is necessarily right for you. Just let yourself, self 2, observe whatever it finds interesting and ignore comments from self 1, which will want to be making up little formulas for you to follow. As you observe, certain things will stand out or come to the foreground of your attention spontaneously. Allow self 2 to focus on elements that, in its intelligence, it might be ready to experiment with. How to watch the pros. When I was a child, I used to play touch football, and I noticed that I played quite a lot better when I'd just come home after my dad had taken me to see the San Francisco 49ers play. I hadn't studied the passing technique of Frankie Albert, but I had picked up something, and it made a difference when I played. I think most people have experienced something very similar to this. Although it is obvious that we can learn a great deal by watching better players play tennis, we have to learn how to watch. The best method is to simply watch without assuming that how the pro swings is how you should be swinging. In many cases, for a beginner to try to swing like a pro would be like asking a baby to walk before it has crawled. To formulate technique while watching the pro or by trying to imitate too closely can be detrimental to your natural learning process. Instead, allow yourself to focus on whatever most interests you about the movements of the pro you are watching. Self 2 will automatically pick up elements of the stroke that are useful to it and discard what is not useful. With each new swing, observe how it feels and how it works. Allow the natural learning process to lead you toward your best stroke. Do not force yourself to make the change. Just allow self 2 to play around while it searches for new stroke possibilities. In doing so, it will use what it can of the hints picked up in observation of the pro. Based on my experience and the experience of those I have worked with, Self, too, has very good instincts about when it is time to work on any particular element of your stroke. In learning how to learn by watching pros play, you may want to alternate between external observation and experimentation on the court until you have confidence that you can access the particular stroke technique you are working on. With the inner game approach, the final authority stays inside during the alternation between external observation or remembrance of an external instruction and total focus of awareness on your own movements, but there is no judgment necessary in the process. You see differences between what you are doing and the external model, but simply notice them and continue to observe. Feel your own movements and check the results. The prevailing learning mindset is a freedom to search for the feel that works for you. In summary, I believe someone who has discovered his or her best stroke can help you discover your best stroke. Knowledge of technique learned by one person can give another an advantage in discovering what technique works best. But it is dangerous to make that person's stroke or any stroke description into your standard for right and wrong. Self One easily gets enamored of formulas that tell it where the racket should be and when. It likes the feeling of control it gets from doing it by the book. But Self Two likes the feeling of flow, of the whole stroke as one thing. The inner game is an encouragement to keep in touch with the Self 2 learning process you were born with, while avoiding getting caught up in trying too hard to make your strokes conform to an outside model. Use outside models in your learning, but don't let them use you. Natural learning is and always will be from the inside out, not vice versa. You are the learner, and it is your individual internal learning process that ultimately governs your learning. What I like about this approach is that I do not have the feeling that I am fitting myself or my students into an external model that may be in fashion for the moment, but that I am using any external model to further help me take a step in the natural evolution toward my very best strokes. After an inner game tennis lesson, a golf professional put it this way: "What I consider to be the right technique for my swing is ever-changing day by day. My model is always being destroyed and rebuilt as I learn more and more. My technique is always evolving." Self-2's nature is to evolve every chance it gets. As your technique evolves, you will start to become better at learning technique and be able to make big changes in a short period of time. As you discover Self-2's learning capabilities, not only will your tennis strokes improve, but you will have increased your capacity to learn anything. Opposite is a table that can give you an idea of how to take instructions on any strokes from a pro, a tennis magazine, or book, and alter them into an awareness instruction that will facilitate the discovery of your own optimal technique. These observations should be made over the course of as many shots as it takes, until Self 2 has had the chance to experiment and has settled on its preferred stroke. If you have a teacher, let him or her teach, but keep Self 2 in control, because it really is your greatest resource. Stroke, technical instruction, awareness instruction. Ground strokes. Follow through at shoulder level. Notice the level of your follow through relative to your shoulder. Take your racket back early. Observe where your racket is when the ball bounces. Get down to the ball. Feel the extent of knee bend on the next 10 shots. Take the racket back below the level of the ball to produce topspin. Notice the level of your racket in relation to the ball at impact. Feel the contact and notice the amount of topspin produced. Hit the ball in the center of the racket. Sense, not with your eyes, where the ball makes contact with the racket face. Plant your back foot when setting up for your ground stroke. Notice what percent of your weight is on your back foot as you prepare to hit your ground strokes. Volley. Hit the ball in front of you. Notice where you are making contact with the ball. Volley the ball deep into the opponent's court. Notice where your volleys are landing in relation to the baseline. Don't take a backswing. Punch the ball. How far back are you taking your racket? What is the minimum amount possible? What amount of backswing provides the best opportunity to punch the ball? Whenever possible, strike the ball before it drops below the level of the net. Focus on the space between the ball and the top of the net. Notice the differing amounts. Serve. Hit the ball with your arm fully extended. Notice the degree of bend in your elbow at the moment of impact with the ball. Toss the ball as high as the extended arm and racket and about 6 inches in front of your lead foot. Observe the height of your toss. Let the ball drop and notice where it lands in relation to your lead foot. Chapter 6. Changing Habits. The previous chapter may have given you some ideas about changes you would like to make in your tennis strokes. The aim of this chapter is to summarize the inner game method of how to effect such changes so that they become a spontaneous part of your behavior. Tips are a dime a dozen, and there are good ones and bad ones. But what is more difficult to come by is a workable way to apply tips, to replace one pattern of behavior with a new one. It is in the process of changing habits that most players experience the greatest difficulty. When one learns how to change a habit, it is a relatively simple matter to learn which ones to change. Once you learn how to learn, you have only to discover what is worth learning. Summarized below is what could be called a new way of learning. Actually, it is not new at all. It is the oldest and most natural way of learning. Simply a method of forgetting the unnatural ways of learning that we have accumulated. Why is it so easy for a child to pick up a foreign language? Primarily because he hasn't learned how to interfere with his own natural, untaught learning process. The inner game way of learning is a return toward this childlike way. By the word learning, I do not mean the collection of information, but the realization of something which actually changes one's behavior. Either external behavior, such as a tennis stroke, or internal behavior, such as a pattern of thought. We all develop characteristic patterns of acting and thinking, and each such pattern exists because it serves a function. The time for change comes when we realize that the same function could be served in a better way. Take the habit of rolling one's racket over after hitting a forehand. This behavior is an attempt to keep the ball from going out. And it exists to produce the desired result. But when the player realizes that by the proper use of topspin, the ball can be kept in the court without the risks of error involved in a rollover follow-through, then the old habit is ready to be dropped. It is much more difficult to break a habit when there is no adequate replacement for it. This difficulty often exists when we become moralistic about our tennis game. If a player reads in a book that it is wrong to roll his racket over, but is not offered a better way to keep the ball in the court, it will take a great deal of willpower to keep his racket flat when he's worried about the ball flying out of the court. As soon as this player gets into a game, you can be sure that he will revert to the stroke that gave some sense of security that his ball would not sail out. It is not helpful to condemn our present behavior patterns, in this case our present imperfect strokes, as bad. It is helpful to see what function these habits are serving, so that if we learn a better way to achieve the same end, we can do so. We never repeat any behavior which isn't serving some function or purpose. It is difficult to become aware of the function of any pattern of behavior while we are in the process of blaming ourselves for having a bad habit. But when we stop trying to suppress or correct the habit, we can see the function it serves, and then an alternative pattern of behavior which serves the same function better emerges quite effortlessly. The groove theory of habits. One hears a lot of talk about grooving one's stroke in tennis. The theory is a simple one. Every time you swing your racket in a certain way, you increase the probabilities that you will swing that way again. In this way, patterns, called grooves, build up, which have a predisposition to repeat themselves. Golfers use the same term. It is as if the nervous system were like a record disc. Every time an action is performed, a slight impression is made in the microscopic cells of the brain, just as a leaf blowing over a fine-grained beach of sand will leave its faint trace. When the same action is repeated, the groove is made slightly deeper. After many similar actions, there is a more recognizable groove into which the needle of behavior seems to fall automatically. then the behavior can be termed grooved. Because these patterns are serving a function, the behavior is reinforced or rewarded and tends to continue. The deeper the groove in the nervous system, the harder it seems to be to break the habit. We have all had the experience of deciding that we will not hit a tennis ball a certain way again. For example, it would seem to be a simple matter to keep your eye on the ball once you understand the obvious benefits of doing so. But time and again, we take our eye off it. Often, in fact, the harder we try to break a habit, the harder it becomes to do. If you watch a player trying to correct the habit of rolling his racket over, he will usually be seen gritting his teeth and exerting all his willpower to get out of his old groove. Watch his racket. After it hits the ball, it will begin to turn over, following the old pattern. Then his muscles will tighten and force it to return to the flat position. You can see in the resulting waiver exactly where the old habit was halted and the new willpower took over. Usually, the battle is won, if at all, only after a great deal of struggle and frustration over the course of some time. It is a painful process to fight one's way out of deep mental grooves. It's like digging yourself out of a trench. But there is a natural and more childlike method. A child doesn't dig his way out of his old grooves. He simply starts new ones. The groove may be there, but you're not in it unless you put yourself there. If you think you are controlled by a bad habit, then you will feel you have to try to break it. A child doesn't have to break the habit of crawling because he doesn't think he has a habit. He simply leaves it, as he finds walking an easier way to get around. Habits are statements about the past, and the past is gone. There may be a deep groove in the nervous system which will take your forehand on the rollover trip if you choose to step into that trench. On the other hand, your muscles are as capable as they ever were of swinging your racket through flat. There is no need to strain all the muscles in the arm to keep the racket flat. In fact, it requires fewer muscles to keep it flat than it does to roll it over. Fighting the fantasy of old habits is what causes the conscientious tennis player to strain and tighten unnecessarily. In short, there is no need to fight old habits. Start new ones. It is the resisting of an old habit that puts you in that trench. Starting a new pattern is easy when done with childlike disregard for imagined difficulties. You can prove this to yourself by your own experience. Making a change in stroke, step by step. Here is a simple summary of the traditional way we have been taught to learn, contrasted with the inner game of learning. Experiment with this method and you will discover a workable way to make any desired change in your game. Step 1. Non-judgmental observation. Where do you want to start? What part of your game needs attention? It is not always the stroke that you judge as worst which is the most ready for change. It is good to pick the stroke you most want to change. Let the stroke tell you if it wants to change. When you want to change what is ready to change, then the process flows. For example, let's assume it is your serve that you decide to focus your attention on. The first step is to forget all the ideas you may have in your mind about what is wrong with it as it is. Erase all your previous ideas and begin serving without exercising any conscious control over your stroke. Observe your serve freshly, as it is now. Let it fall into its own groove for better or worse. Begin to be interested in it and experience it as fully as you can. Notice how you stand and distribute your weight before beginning your motion. Check your grip and the initial position of your racket. Remember, make no corrections. Simply observe without interfering. Next, get in touch with the rhythm of your serving motion. Feel the path of your racket as it describes its swing. Then serve several balls and watch only your wrist motion. Is your wrist limber or tight? Does it have a full snap or something less? Merely watch. Also observe your toss during several serves. Experience your tossing motion. Does the ball go to the same spot each time? Where is that spot? Finally, become aware of your follow-through. Before long, you will feel that you know your serve very well, as it is presently grooved. You may also be aware of the results of your motion, that is, the number of balls hit into the net, the speed and accuracy of those that reach the far court. Awareness of what is, without judgment, is relaxing, and is the best precondition for change. It is not unlikely that during this observation period, some changes have already begun to take place unintentionally. If so, let the process continue. There's nothing wrong with making unconscious changes. You avoid the complication of thinking that you made the change, and thus of the need to remind yourself how to do it. After you have watched and felt your serve for 5 minutes or so, you may have a strong idea about the particular element of the stroke that needs attention. Ask your serve how it would like to be different. Maybe it wants a more fluid rhythm. Maybe it wants more power or a greater amount of spin. If 90% of the balls are going into the net, it's probably quite obvious what needs to change. In any case, let yourself feel the change most desired, then observe a few more serves. Step 2. Picture the desired outcome. Let's assume that what is desired in your serve is more power. The next step is to picture your serve with more power. One way to do this might be to watch the motion of someone who gets a lot of power in his serve. Don't overanalyze. Simply absorb what you see and try to feel what he feels. Listen to the sound of the ball after it hits the racket and watch the results. Then take some time to imagine yourself hitting the ball with power, using the stroke which is natural to you. In your mind's eye, picture yourself serving, filling in as much visual and tactile detail as you can. Hear the sound at impact and see the ball speed toward the service court. Step 3. Trust self too. Begin serving again, but with no conscious effort to control your stroke. In particular, resist any temptation to try to hit the ball harder. Simply let your serve begin to serve itself. Having asked for more power, just let it happen. This isn't magic, so give your body a chance to explore the possibilities. But no matter what the results, keep self one out of it. If increased power does not come immediately, don't force it. Trust the process and let it happen. If after a short while the serve does not seem to be moving in the direction of increased power, you may want to return to step one. Ask yourself what is inhibiting speed. If you don't come up with an answer, you might ask a pro to take a look. Let's say the pro observes that you are not getting a maximum wrist snap at the top of your swing. He may observe that one reason is that you are holding your racket too tightly to allow for flexibility. The habit of holding the racket tightly and swinging with a stiff wrist usually comes from a conscious attempt to hit the ball hard. Experience how it feels to hold your racket with different degrees of firmness. Allow your wrist to show you what it feels like to move in a full, flexible arc. Don't assume you know just because you've been told. Let yourself feel the wrist motion intimately. If you are in any doubt, ask the pro to show you the motion, not tell you about it. Then, in your mind's eye, imagine your serving motion, this time seeing distinctly your wrist moving from a fully cocked position, reaching up to the sky, then snapping down until it points to the court on the follow-through. After you have fixed the image of your new wrist motion, serve again. Remember that if you try to snap your wrist, it will probably over-tighten, so just let it go. Let it be flexible. Allow it to snap in an ever-increasing arc as much as it wants to. Encourage it, but don't force it. Not trying does not mean being limp. Discover for yourself what it does mean. Step 4. Non-judgmental observation of change and results. As you are letting your serve serve itself, your job is simply to observe. Watch the process without exercising control over it. If you feel you want to help, don't. The more you can bring yourself to put trust in the natural process that is at work, the less you will tend to fall into the usual interfering patterns of trying too hard, judging and thinking, and the frustration that inevitably follows. During this process, it is still important to have a certain lack of concern for where the ball is going. As you allow one element of a stroke to change, others will be affected. As you increase your wrist snap, you will alter your rhythm and timing. Initially, this may result in inconsistency, but if you continue with the process, simply allowing the serve to serve itself while you remain attentive and patient, the other elements of the serve will make the needed adjustments. Since power is a function of more than the wrist, after your snap is grooved, you may want to let your attention shift to your toss, your balance, or some other element. Observe these and allow changes to occur. Serve until you have reason to believe that a groove has been established. To test if the groove is there, serve a few balls with all your attention solely on the ball. Be engrossed in the seams of the ball as you throw the ball into the air so that you are sure that your mind is not telling your body what to do. If the serve is serving itself in the new manner, a groove has automatically been started. The usual way of learning. Step 1. Criticize or judge past behavior. Examples. I'm hitting my forehand rotten again today. Damn it, why do I keep missing those easy setups? I'm not doing anything the coach told me to do in my last lesson. You were great rallying, now you're playing worse than your grandmother. The above is usually delivered in a punitive, belittling tone. Step 2. Tell yourself to change, instructing with word commands repeatedly. Examples. Keep your racket low, keep your racket low, keep your racket low. Hit the ball in front of you, in front, no, damn it, further. Don't flick your wrist, keep it stiff. You stupid bum, you did it again. Toss the ball good and high this time, then reach up, remember to snap your wrist, and don't change grips in mid-serve. Hit this one into the cross-court corner. Step 3. Try hard. Make yourself do it right. In this step, Self 1, having told Self 2 what to do, tries to control the action. Unnecessary body and facial muscles are used. There is a tightness which prevents maximum fluidity of stroke and precision of movement. Self 2 is not trusted. Step 4. Critical judgment about results leading to a Self 1 vicious cycle. When one has tried hard to perform an action right, it is difficult not to become either frustrated at failure or anxious about success. Both emotions are distracting to one's focus and prevent full experiencing of what happens. Negative judgment of the results of one's efforts tends to make one try even harder. Positive evaluation tends to make one try to force oneself into the same pattern on the next shot. Both positive and negative thinking inhibit spontaneity. The inner game way of learning. Step 1. Observe existing behavior non-judgmentally. Examples. The last three of my backhands landed long by about 2 feet. My racket seems to be hesitating instead of following through all the way. Maybe I should observe the level of my backswing. It's well above my waist. There, that shot got hit with more pace, yet it stayed in. The above is delivered in an interested, somewhat detached tone. Step 2. Picture desired outcome. No commands are used. Self 2 is asked to perform in the desired way to achieve the desired results. Self 2 is shown by use of visual image and felt action any element of stroke desired. If you wish the ball to go to the cross-court corner, you simply imagine the necessary path of the ball to the target. Do not try to correct for past errors. Step 3. Let it happen. Trust Self 2. Having requested your body to perform a certain action, give it the freedom to do it. The body is trusted without the conscious control of mind. The serve seems to serve itself. Effort is initiated by Self 2, but there is no trying by Self 1. Letting it happen doesn't mean going limp. It means letting Self 2 use only the muscles necessary for the job. Nothing is forced. Continue the process. Be willing to allow Self 2 to make changes within changes until a natural groove is formed. Step 4. Non-judgmental, calm observation of the results leading to continuing observation and learning. Though the player knows his goal, he is not emotionally involved in achieving it, and is therefore able to watch the results calmly and experience the process. By so doing, concentration is best achieved, as is learning at its highest rate of speed. Making new changes is only necessary when results do not conform to the image given. Otherwise, only continuing observation of the behavior undergoing change is necessary. Watch it change. Don't do the changing. The process is an incredibly simple one. The important thing is to experience it. Don't intellectualize it. See what it feels like to ask yourself to do something and let it happen without any conscious trying. For most people, it is a surprising experience, and the results speak for themselves. This method of learning can be practiced in most endeavors on or off the court. The more you let yourself perform free of control on the tennis court, the more confidence you tend to gain in the beautiful mechanism that is the human body. The more you trust it, the more capable it seems to become. Watch out for the return of self-one. But there is one pitfall I should mention. I have noticed that after being thrilled by the improvements they are able to make in their tennis game by letting it happen, students often revert the next day to trying as hard as usual. What is surprising is that though they are playing much worse tennis, they don't seem to mind. At first, this puzzled me. Why would one go back to letting self-one control the show if the results were so clearly less effective? I had to search myself for the answer. I realized that there was a distinctly different kind of satisfaction gained in the two methods of hitting the ball. When you try hard to hit the ball correctly and it goes well, you get a certain kind of ego satisfaction. You feel that you are in control, that you are master of the situation. But when you simply allow the serve to serve itself, it doesn't seem as if you deserve the credit. It doesn't feel as if it were you who hit the ball. You tend to feel good about the ability of your body and possibly even amazed by the results, but the credit and sense of personal accomplishment are replaced by another kind of satisfaction. If a person is out on the court mainly to satisfy the desires and doubts of ego, it is likely that in spite of the lesser results, he will choose to let self-one play the major role. Give self-two the credit. When a player experiences what it means to let go and allow self-two to play the game, not only do his shots tend to gain accuracy and power, but he feels an exhilarating sense of relaxation even during rapid movements. In an attempt to repeat this quality of performance, the player often allows self-one to creep back on the scene with a remark such as, "Now I've got the secret to this game. All I have to do is make myself relax." But of course, the instant I try to make myself relax, true relaxation vanishes, and in its place is a strange phenomenon called trying to relax. Relaxation happens only when allowed, not as a result of trying or making. Self-one should not be expected to give up its control all at once. It begins to find its proper role only as one progresses in the art of relaxed concentration. Chapter 7. Concentration, Learning to Focus. Up to this point, we have been discussing the art of letting go of self-one control and letting self-two play the game spontaneously. The primary emphasis has been on giving practical examples of the value of letting go of self-judging, thinking too much, trying too hard, all forms of over-control. But even if the reader is wholly convinced of the value of thus quieting self-one, it may not be found to come easily. My experience over the years is that the best way to quiet the mind is not by telling it to shut up, or by arguing with it, or criticizing it for criticizing you. Fighting the mind does not work. What works best is learning to focus it. Learning to focus is the subject of this chapter, and to whatever extent we learn this primary art, it can benefit us in most anything we do. Strangely, even when one has experienced the practical benefit of a still mind, we continue to find it an elusive state. In spite of the fact that I deliver my most effective performance when I permit the spontaneous self-two to be in control, there is still a recurring impulse to think about how I did it, make a formula out of it, and thus to bring it into self-one's domain where it can feel in control. Sometimes I recognize this impulse as the persistent self-one wanting to gain credit, to be something it really isn't, and in the process, spawning an endless flow of distracting thoughts that distort both perception and response. There was a time at the beginning of my exploration of the inner game that I found myself able to let go of almost all conscious effort on my serve, and as a result, the serve just seemed to serve itself with rare consistency and power. For a period of about 2 weeks, 90% of my first serves went in. I didn't serve a single double fault. Then one day my roommate, another professional, challenged me to a match. I accepted, saying half-jokingly, "But you better watch out. I found the secret to the serve." The next day we played, and I served 2 double faults the first game. The moment I tried to apply some secret, Self One was back in the picture again, this time under the subtle guise of trying to let go. Self One wanted to show off to my roommate. It wanted the credit. Even though I soon realized what had happened, the magic of the spontaneous, effortless serving didn't return in its same pure form for some time. In short, the problem of letting go of self-one and its interfering activities is not easy. A clear understanding of the problem can help, but practical demonstrations help more, and practicing the process of letting go helps still more. Nevertheless, I do not believe that ultimately the mind can be controlled by the mere act of letting go, that is, by a simply passive process. To still the mind, one must learn to put it somewhere. It cannot just be let go. It must be focused. If peak performance is a function of a still mind, then we are led to the question of where and how to focus it. As one achieves focus, the mind quiets. As the mind is kept in the present, it becomes calm. Focus means keeping the mind now and here. Relaxed concentration is the supreme art because no art can be achieved without it, while with it, much can be achieved. One cannot reach the limit of one's potential in tennis or any endeavor without learning it. What is even more compelling is that tennis can be a marvelous medium through which skill in focus of mind can be developed. By learning to focus while playing tennis, one develops a skill that can heighten performance in every other aspect of life. To learn this art, practice is needed, and there is never a time or situation that you cannot practice, save perhaps sleep. In tennis, the most convenient and practical object of focus is the ball itself. Probably the most often repeated dictum in tennis is, "Watch the ball," yet few players see it well. The instruction is an appeal for the player to simply pay attention. It does not mean to think about the ball, how easy or difficult this shot is to make, how I should swing my racket at it, or what Tom, Dick, or Harry will think if I make the shot or miss it. The focused mind only picks up on those aspects of a situation that are needed to accomplish the task at hand. It is not distracted by other thoughts or external events. It is totally engrossed in whatever is relevant in the here and now. Watching the ball. Watching the ball means to focus your attention on the sight of it. I have found that the most effective way to deepen concentration through sight is to focus on something subtle, not easily perceived. It's easy to see the ball, but not so easy to notice the exact pattern made by its seams as it spins. The practice of watching the seams produces interesting results. After a short time, the player discovers that he is seeing the ball much better than when he was just watching it. When looking for the pattern made by the seams, one naturally watches the ball all the way to one's racket and begins to focus his attention on it earlier than before. The ball should be watched from the time it leaves the opponent's racket to the time it hits yours. Sometimes the ball even begins to appear bigger or to be moving slower. These are natural results of true focus. But seeing the ball better is only a partial benefit of focusing on its seams. Because the pattern made by the spinning ball is so subtle, it tends to engross the mind more completely. The mind is so absorbed in watching the pattern that it forgets to try too hard. To the extent that the mind is preoccupied with the seams, it tends not to interfere with the natural movements of the body. Furthermore, the seams are always here and now, and if the mind is on them, it is kept from wandering to the past or future. The practice of this exercise will enable the tennis player to achieve deeper and deeper states of concentration. Most players who practice seam watching as a discipline find it helpful almost immediately, but after a while, they often discover their minds wandering again. The mind has difficulty focusing on a single object for an extended period of time. Let's face it, as interesting as a tennis ball may be for some, it is not going to easily capture the restless mind so habituated to distractions of every kind. Bounce hit. So the question arises as to how to maintain focus for extended periods of time. The best way is to allow yourself to get interested in the ball. How do you do this? By not thinking you already know all about it, no matter how many thousands of balls you have seen in your life. Not assuming you already know is a powerful principle of focus. One thing you don't know about the ball is exactly when it is going to bounce and when it is going to hit either your racket or your opponent's. Perhaps the most simple and effective means of focus I found was a very simple exercise I called bounce hit. The instructions I gave students were very simple. Say the word bounce out loud the instant you see the ball hit the court, and the word hit the instant the ball makes contact with the racket, either racket. Saying the words out loud gave both me and the student the chance to hear whether the words were simultaneous with the events of bounce and hit. As the student said bounce, hit, bounce, hit, bounce, hit, bounce, not only would it keep his eyes focused on four very key positions of the ball during each exchange, but the hearing of the rhythm and cadence of the bouncing and hitting of the ball seemed to hold the attention for longer periods of time. The results were the same as with any effective focus. The exercise would give the player better feedback from the ball and, at the same time, help clear his mind of distractions. It's hard to be saying bounce hit and at the same time over-instructing yourself, trying too hard, or worrying about the score. I found that beginners would learn effective footwork and beginning-level strokes and often be able to carry on quite long exchanges from the baseline within 15 or 20 minutes without even thinking about it, while self one was kept busy tracking the bounces and hits. Surprisingly, I also found that many advanced players had more difficulty with the exercise because they had more going on in their minds that they thought was necessary to good execution. When they would try the experiment of letting go of their controlling thoughts and just focus on the bounce and hit, they were usually very surprised and sometimes a little embarrassed about how well self two performed without the usual kinds of self one thought processes that they had felt were contributing so much to their game. One of the easiest ways to maintain interest in the ball is to not look at it as a stationary object, but as an object in motion. Watching its seams helps focus your attention on the object itself, but it is just as important to increase your awareness of the flight of each ball as it moves toward you, and then again as it leaves your racket. My favorite focus of attention during a point is on the particular trajectories of each shot, both mine and my opponent's. I notice the height of the ball as it passes over the net, its apparent speed, and with utmost care, the angle at which it rises after bouncing. I also observe whether the ball is rising, falling, or at its apex in the instant before the racket makes contact. I give the same careful attention to the trajectory of my own shot. Soon, I become more and more aware of the rhythm of the alternating shots of each point, and am able to increase my sense of anticipation. It is this rhythm, both seen and heard, which holds fascination for my mind and enables it to focus for longer periods of time without becoming distracted. Focus is not achieved by staring hard at something. It is not trying to force focus, nor does it mean thinking hard about something. Natural focus occurs when the mind is interested. When this occurs, the mind is drawn irresistibly toward the object or subject of interest. It is effortless and relaxed, not tense and overly controlled. When watching the tennis ball, allow yourself to fall into focus. If your eyes are squinting or straining, you are trying too hard. If you find yourself chastising yourself for losing focus, then you may be over-controlling. Let the ball attract your mind, and both it and your muscles will stay appropriately relaxed. Listening to the ball. It rarely occurs to a player to listen to the ball, but I have found great value in this focus. When the ball hits your racket, it makes a distinct sound, the quality of which varies considerably, depending on its proximity to the sweet spot, the angle of the face, the distribution of your weight, and where the ball is met. If you listen closely to the sounds of one ball after another, you will soon be able to distinguish a number of different kinds and qualities of sounds. Soon, it will be possible to recognize the sound produced by an overspin forehand hit squarely and an underspin forehand hit slightly off-center. You will come to know the sound of a flat backhand and to distinguish it from one hit with an open face. One day, when I was practicing this form of concentration while serving, I began hitting the ball unusually well. I could hear a sharp crack instead of the usual sound at the moment of impact. It sounded terrific, and the ball had more speed and accuracy. After I realized how well I was serving, I resisted the temptation to figure out why, and simply asked my body to do whatever was necessary to reproduce that crack. I held the sound in my memory, and to my amazement, my body reproduced it time and again. Through this experience, I learned how effective the remembering of certain sounds can be as a cue for the built-in computer within our brains. While one listens to the sounds of his